Hello and welcome to the Genre Fiction Podcast. I am Jack Roney, chatting with my usual partner in crime, Harry Colfer, and fantastic to have Lauren Daniels
G'day.
With us once again. How are we doing, folks?
Hello. Good.
Good.
So this episode, we are going to start talking about some genre-specific issues that you see, Lauren, when you are doing your editing. So
yes.
Let's get straight into it. So for speculative fiction stories, first of all, can you define what speculative fiction is, and
yes.
then talk us through some of the issues that you see when you are doing editing?
Yes, there is some confusion when people talk about speculative fiction or spec fic, if you're cool. But the bottom line is it asks the question, what if? So we're talking about, science fiction, fantasy, and under fantasy. Actually, even with science fiction, there's hard science fiction, there's softer science fiction. With fantasy, you might have urban fantasy or high fantasy, epic fantasy. You're also talking about horror, and horror has a massive, a lot of different layers there and a lot of different expressions. So, I'm a horror writer as well as a magic realism writer. I do love speculative fiction. I edit a fair bit of it. It's very popular right now. A lot of people want to throw their hat in the ring. It can also include graphic novels. You know, it can include comic books or superheroes. It's what if this happened? You know, it can include things like Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. So it's a really wide net. So some of the things that I'll see, because it's a wide now, I'll try to take it one bit at a time. So maybe with something like fantasy, I'll see an author who says, this is my first book of three, and they start pitching me all three books. And I say to them, you need to be able to write the first book well before you start pitching a series, a trilogy, learn how to write the first book well. And you'd be surprised where the first book's not written very well. There are too many characters. There's just the lack of agency on behalf of some of the characters, meaning they're not affecting the plot. Things are happening to them, but they're not making choices and advancing the story. The magical systems might be a bit weak. There might not be a cost to those magical systems being used. You can have homogenous worlds or people very similar to each other. You need real conflict. There will be fight scenes in fantasy as well. I'll see a lot of fight scenes where every chapter has one. And I'm thinking, this is getting very repetitive. What's to be gained here? What changes with this wound that the protagonist has gained? And a supernatural system that's consistent and it's not limitless. There has to be limits and rules that are in place. And when it comes to horror, I think it has to be geared towards a certain audience. And if you're writing splatterpunk, you know what you can get away with. You're aware of the tropes. You know what your audience is hungry for.
What's splatterpunk?
Oh, splatterpunk is like gory stuff.
Oh, right. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like my stuff.
Yes. I have a few friends who write it and they've done extremely well. It's incredible. But then I kind of lean into the psychological stuff where you're using horror as a way to tell stories about the human condition. One really great example would be of a film is the Babadook film it's from a South Australian screenwriter.
Yeah.
She's talking about grief, and so many, there are so many Australian authors too, Australia, New Zealand. Lee Murray just wrote a novella called Dispatches, which is getting into military situations. There's trauma in there. The Dardanelles is the landscape. So, you have so much that you can talk about and you have to deliver. So that's speculative fiction.
Would it be fair to say with speculative fiction as opposed to say fantasy or sci-fi, that it's got to be believable? So for example, one of my stories has got a historical mystery with a twist of time travel.
Yes.
But the feedback I've been given from people is that it's palatable. Everyone knows that time travel, well, in theory, it isn't a thing. But if people can,
isn't it?
if it's digestible, if it's believable, even though it's fanciful, but it's in a setting where it's kind of people are accepting it because, you know, there's so many stories. What's that movie? I think it's Nicolas Cage. It's called Next, where he can see like 4 seconds into the future. So it's a what if question in the real world, and how would a character deal with that, you know, that kind of power? So it's kind of got that, just a, that's kind of how I interpret spec fic, is that it's got a hint of paranormal, but in a real world where everything else about the story is believable and set in a real setting, as opposed to a fantasy world or a sci-fi world. It's a believable, realistic setting with this twist of what if, it's slight twist of paranormal. You know, the movie Gwyneth Paltrow, Sliding Doors, you know, where what would happen if she gets onto the train versus what happens when she doesn't get on the train and how her life goes in two different directions, and those sort of things. You know, it's just got that slight twist of the paranormal, the what if, but in a real setting. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a pretty wide scope. I love where you've taken us, though, where the story comes first. It doesn't matter if you're writing a high fantasy or, you know, you're taking us to Mars. The story has to come first. And that is most important. The rest of it is world building, and it makes it rich and it gives readers an escape. But the story is crucial, and it has to be believable. And the characters, even if the characters are appalling and they're awful and you don't like any of them, you're still intrigued by them. You know, you enjoy disliking them. So that story has to come first wherever we are. So speculative fiction does include high fantasy. It does include paranormal romance, where the world could be weird. I mean, Hunger Games falls into falls into spec fic, but it has a lot of elasticity. I mean, H.G. Wells, you know, his stuff falls into spec fic. It's Frankenstein, you know, it's all there.
Okay. But
for the really good ones that are memorable, like you said, Jack, you've got a story that it just resonates with readers first. We don't get carried off into another realm and lose ourselves, lose our story.
What about moving on to the next topic or the next genre, historical fiction? I know there's some comments that you've got about, you know, overdoing the historical research and, you know, to the detriment of the story.
I personally think, from editing a fair whack of these things, that historical fiction is the hardest to write. I do. If you're going to do it right, if you're going to do it really well and put the story first, you can fall into the trap of research. And I think of, it's not fiction, but Ernest Hemingway wrote Death in the Afternoon, where he wrote about bullfighting. And he says in the opener that he researched that for 10 years and he could research it for another 10 before he feels confident enough to write about this. And I think that's what happens to historical fiction writers. They're researching, they want to have all the details, and they can spin their wheels and get mired and feel like they're never going to have enough information. You know, if they, especially if they're those gatherers of information, you know, people who get addicted to that stuff. I get it. I've written historical horror fiction, and I started to get scared that I didn't know enough to write about 1881 and what happened, you know, in New Orleans. I fixated on a time I was reading Ship Manifest and I got buried. But then I found out my deadline was 30 days closer than I thought. And so I had to jump in and just do it. And I did it. And the story got accepted, I'm very pleased to say. But
that does tend to focus your mind, doesn't it, when they get a deadline?
I was like, everyone, leave me alone. I'm not coming out of my room. Yes. But I think with historical research, it can weaken the drama. It can make characters really flat. So what happens is the author gets lost in documentation, but they forget about narrative arc and character arc and all that stuff. So they have to come back and remember it, and they may have to let go, kill their darlings, of some historical research that they've done. You really, like we mentioned in the other podcast, we want to pepper the story with historical facts so that it's believable. We don't want to give the reader a tour of all the research that we did. We just want to lace through enough so that the reader sees it. In fact, it's also like the accented English. If you have a character who has a dialect or has a, is English as a second language, we don't want to overdo it. We want to make it believable so that reader just hears it that way. And the same with historical fiction. They have to open their eyes and see the Roaring Twenties, or they have to open their eyes and find themselves in ancient Greece.
I think sometimes as writers, we like to try and show the reader how clever we are. You know, we've done all this research and we know a lot of stuff. So I'm going to tell you about all the stuff that I know. And I remember I tell people this a lot, and I think I mentioned this on previous episodes of the podcast. Lauren, when you did the structural edit of my manuscript for what became the Ghost Train and the Scarlet Moon, my first, I think it was in the prologue, the first probably about 10 pages was all the scene setting in Labor Day 1947, and I've gone to great efforts to describe what, you know, my intention was to sort of show to the reader what or to imagine what Brisbane Labor Day 1947 looked like. So I was describing the trams driving in up and down Queen Street and what Brisbane City looked like, and preparing for the Labor Day march and the steam trains at Central Train Station. And, you know, I'd done all this research and old photographs, and I wanted to paint the picture. I remember your advice. I remember we had this conversation on the phone initially when you'd done your first read through, and you said, look, I've done the report. There's a few things. I've been pretty brutal with some of the things I said, but I was honest. One of the things you said was, you've got to, and so that first chapter eventually goes on to where the train that all the passengers have got onto goes up, travels out through Ferny Grove. It goes over a rise, and it's as it's going over the rise and heading towards Sanford, where it's going to go out of control and crash. You said start the story at the top of the hill. The train is just over the rise, and the train is just lost control. That's where you start the story. I went, but what about all that, you know, beautiful writing about Brisbane?
I'm sorry,
but I was able to salvage. But the beauty of the story was that was great advice, and that's what I did. So pretty much the first page starts with, you know, the train is out of control as it's going over the rise, and you've gotten this heightened tension right from page one. That other information I was able to implant and drip feed it later, so I didn't lose that. I didn't just hit the delete button. I was able to salvage it and reuse it later, but I was able to use it in a way that was just kind of drip feeding what, you know, what the historical sort of imagery was like. So yeah, there you go. It's important to get that advice and to follow that advice.
And you know what, Jack, you couldn't skip that. You had to write that out, organize it in your mind. You had to see it for yourself by writing it. And then you could use it later. I think that's something it's important for listeners to think about. No time is wasted. No effort is wasted. You're working it out. And so I'm so pleased that's the example that you cited, because we all need to be told, start at the top of the hill.
Yes.
You know, that's it's a good metaphor for all of us.
It is, yeah.
And that you can't skip the leaving the station part. You can't skip the Queen Street Mall. Like, you have to walk through it in order to orient yourself and to make this real for you as the author, so then it's real for your readers.
Yeah, great advice. Now, moving on to the next genre of romance, we did have the benefit of having Ali Blake, romance writer Ali Blake, on our episode a few weeks back, and she gave us a lot of information about romance and the difference between what a romance is and a love story is, and, you know, there's got to be a happy ending for a romance versus a love story could have a tragic ending. Romeo and Juliet is a love story, not so much a romance. So yeah. tell us about, from an editor's point of view, tips for writers of romance that you might discover some issues.
And you know, I also include in that stories that include a romance where there's attraction and there's elements there. And I think for me as an editor, what I commonly will see is that things just unfold too easily, where I think it's really good for people who want to write romance to do some reading about tension and character development, really educate themselves on some of those wonderful books out there that can prime them for building tension, conflict, character flaws, where two people just collide too easily, because life is messy and feelings are messy. And I mean, you know, attraction can be scary and overwhelming and repellent, like all that stuff. I guess for me, when I read a romance, or, you know, as an editor, or I see a romantic element in a story, I want it to be human and difficult, you know, not simple. Because really, I started out in psychology as well. I did 2 years of a psych degree before I went home and said to my parents, I have to switch to writing. And my mother said, oh dear God, you're going to be an alcoholic. And my dad was like, yay, I'm so glad you're going to be a writer.
I thought he was really cheering you up for being an alcoholic.
yeah, you'll be an alcoholic. No. But just that initial response. But my mother also grew up in New York City, and she witnessed a bit as well, because she was like 5, 6, 7, 8 years old growing up in this in a restaurant in the village where writers from the Algonquin Club would hang out. So she saw them as a bit rude, loud, rowdy. I can't imagine, you know, what she saw. Like, of course, we're also civilized, right?
Of course.
So I guess to come back to romance, I think try not to be cliche, avoid the tired old tropes, and also mashups are really popular right now. So genre mashups where people try paranormal romance or urban fantasy romance, you know, to combine different elements and to test your mettle as a writer, try something you haven't tried before, get a little funky.
Yeah, and that was an admission I made, that, you know, I've deliberately steered away from any concept of romance because it was just outside my comfort zone. I could write a crime scene and talk about that sort of thing, but dead bodies, autopsies, I'm quite happy and quite comfortable. But get sort of touchy and romantic, I start to kind of squirm in my seat. So that would be a real challenge for me. But when we spoke with Ali Blake, we talked about that you can make your stories more powerful by adding and having crossover between genres, where you could still have a crime story with an element of romance, or vice versa.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's psychological. I think that's where I was headed before, is that like attraction and romance are psychological. Do a little homework on that. Try to understand the body language that comes with it and the conflict that comes with it and why certain people are attracted to certain people, and get your hands around that, because that will make your stories more human, more authentic. You know, how people are attracted to versions of themselves they wish they could be, that kind of stuff. There's so much psychology there worth just exploring and understanding. And yeah, I think the best writers also make an effort to understand themselves, and therefore they write better stories, you know.
Yeah. And just a final question about romance. You talked about with other genres, and we talked about foreshadowing and use of prologues, and, you know, starting at the top of the hill, you know, grab your reader early. Does that still apply for romance books or stories, or can you afford to get away with a more of a slow burn, to start with a slower build for romance stories, or should you still grab your reader early?
I personally think the hook, there has to be a hook in any kind of genre these days, and they've been saying attention spans have gotten even shorter, which, good lord, with all the swiping and the TikToking, we're getting even harder to keep on board. So I think every genre, and you know, it'll work for your readership. It'll work for what your readers are after. So, you know, you write your first draft for yourself, and then you start editing for your audience, right? And so you think about, well, what's working? And you're reading other people too, to see what sort of hooks are working. But I mean, that kind of engagement, that kind of come with me, I'm making a promise to you, you know?
Yeah. I think it was just something you said about watching people and psychology and things like that. It is interesting, and it just struck me, you've got two people here, Jack and myself, whose job for decades has been observing people. You know, as a detective, you've got to be able to watch people, interview them, know what they're thinking. And as a paramedic, you go into a scene, you've got to be able to read body language, know whether it's safe, whether it's not, whether you need to ask more questions to get more of a more of a story as to what's going on. And so we've actually spent decades, both of us, reading people before we've actually started writing about them, which
absolutely,
I think, helps.
Harry, Anton Chekhov was a GP, and I think it's really interesting to think about that. You know, people would be lying to him all day long, saying, oh no, they gave up the vodka, they're not doing that. Oh, they haven't touched it since the last time they saw, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, they've lost a couple of kilos. You know, like, yes, all this. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, some of the best writers are people who have a career in listening and observing and really trying to understand people. And they also seem to have a penchant for trying to understand themselves. I think the two go hand in hand.
I've read some of
transformations too, you know.
David Baldacci, I think he was a lawyer. And he writes legal thrillers, and clearly he, you know, his own experiences, you know, really bleeds into what he writes.
Yes.
Okay. Let's jump ahead now. So I think we've covered off on romance. What about sci-fi issues that you see, I see there's a note you made about not enough dramatic action, too much info dumping. How does that apply for sci-fi? I think you've sort of touched on
Yes.
some of this.
Yes, that does fall under, yes. It falls under speculative fiction, but in the manuscripts that I'll see, there won't be enough dramatic action. I won't see enough action beats, enough scene work. And there'll be so much world building, description, detail. Let me take you on a tour. Let me show you how these buildings work. Let me show you how the spaceships work. And I always tell the author, dial it down a little bit and just show us with this stuff in action. So instead of giving us a tour, showing us a video, it's amazing how many times in science fiction that the author is showing the reader a video of something, a presentation of something. And I say, no, just walk us through it. Show the person on the job, and hold back. Remember poker, you keep your cards close and you throw one down. You just have to just hold back a little bit, breast your cards, as they say. Drip
Yeah,
feed was a term that you used before, Jack. So
it's almost
that's a
like
big one.
it's similar to the historical fiction sort of issue that you've got, whereby somebody spent all of this time either researching or world building, and they want to prove to the reader that they've spent all of this time rather than just going off and drip feeding, because he's like, no, I've spent months coming up with this new
Yes.
world, and I want to show how much of it. And unfortunately, it gets boring.
Been years, years, Harry, where I get guys in my workshops who say, I've been world building for 3 years and I can't get traction. And I'll say to them, you know why? You're scared to write the story. You are. You're freezing. You're having so much fun drawing maps and writing character that you've actually choked. And you need to study story form. It doesn't just happen. People don't just get the answers. There's a reason why Tolkien and Charles Williams and C.S. Lewis hung out at the pub at Oxford to toss around ideas and discuss format and plot and that. And I know people will say, oh, but there's so much singing and walking in Lord of the Rings. I'm like, yes, okay. It was a story of its time. Let's not get confused with presentism versus contextualism. It was a story of its time. But still, all that discussion and that support and that, what is story? What makes plot? What makes character development? Like, it takes time to sort this. I think it takes a lifetime to sort it out. And we're lucky we're not like ballet or opera, where they age out at 30. We're just going to get better and better at this,
I think for science fiction writers, there's probably, without sort of stereotyping people, you've probably got male writers who might have come from, say, technical backgrounds. They've got the, you know, the chemists, or they've got scientific or IT knowledge, and they've always been drawn to that type of story where they're of a very high technical nature. The physics and the science behind rocket ships and trajectories and everything else that comes on screen. So they know this stuff, and again, they want to share this with the reader. They want to again, it's about trying to impress the reader with all this knowledge that they've either gained or that they've got. Now let's
They
move
have
on
to put the
to,
story first.
yes, yep.
Yes.
Now, probably the other end of the spectrum is literary fiction, where again,
Yes.
that's where it is more of a slow burn. It's more about enjoying the art form of the written word. Tell us about some issues that you've come across from an editorial point of view for literary fiction.
That's a good one. I spent most of my time working for a publisher, 15 years, and it was predominantly literary fiction. We had memoirs as well. We opened up to memoirs and historical pieces and biographies and such, but mostly literary fiction. So a lot of literary manuscripts coming through. And I think the number one issue with literary is that the author uses the literary label as an excuse to be vague. And I'll say, I've read this twice now, and I'm not seeing the connection that in your little nutshell synopsis that I asked you to write under 300 words. I'm not seeing the story deliver what you want it to. And I think you're hiding behind the literary label, So I want you to crisp it up. I want you to show up and give us turmoil, give us conflict. There's something to be learned across, and there should be no snobbery between genre and the lit crowd. I'm sorry. We're all trying to do the same stuff. And genre's gotten smarter, it's gotten better, The writing has gotten more polished. The characters have gotten richer. I don't think the genre of 10, 15 years ago it doesn't fly as well as things today. There's more demand. I think readers are smart, they're sophisticated, and they want really good stories, you know? So that line, you know, that was the snobbery that I got when I was studying. Like, how could you even think of writing horror that tripe? And I'm like, Stephen King's It mm-hmm. is tremendous. Like, I don't care what anybody said. The Stand is amazing. So I think those are literary in my mind because of the tackling of death and relationship that are entangled in these stories, right? So the biggest criticism I have of literary is, it, you know, try not to what do I want to say here? Sort it out. Sort it out. Tell your readers what's going on here. You know, don't hold back and say, oh, I'm being misty because it's literary. I mean, I know you don't have to have an ending that's happy or sad. It can be open. And that's kind of a common thing where you're both happy and sad and confused and you're thinking about the stars and all that wonderful stuff. But still, there's something concrete that I'm sinking my teeth into and I'm left with. I'm not saying,
that's for the most part, when I've read anything that could be labeled as literary fiction, that's where I end up feeling is confused as to why I've just spent my time reading that. If you could give me an example of literary fiction, which is an excellent example of what of the genre or the writing form, and let me sort of have something I can go and read and then actually be able to get my head around literary fiction.
One of my favorite books is Life of Pi.
All right, okay.
But the caveat, I would see that as an
adventure.
Oh my God, Harry, read it. Because, well, the first 30 pages are, I'm sorry, I really think the editor should have leaned on him. And yeah, you can quote me on this because a lot of people will say, I tried to start it, but I couldn't get the traction. And I think the first 30 pages where we're meeting the journalist who's interviewing the survivor of this shipwreck, blah, blah, blah. It takes a little while to get going. Yeah. And it's funny because Life Pi was in my bag when I went to see my GP, 10 years ago when it was popular. And she said, I keep trying to start that. And I said, this is my fifth time trying. I said, I'm pushing through. And the thing is, it will reward you. And it's literary because there's so many layers. And what that story is really about, it's about religion and philosophy and how we tell ourselves stories in order to survive a chaotic world, in order to survive the metaphorical shipwrecks that happen to us, in order to survive the evil that we witness. And that, to me, like, I've got goosebumps just talking about it, you know. So that's one of my other favorites, which is more accessible in some ways, is All Quiet on the Western Front. I love that book. And I read it periodically, and it's literary and it's glorious and it's not confusing. It is clear and gorgeous. So there's one, Life of Pi, which is a bit tricky and strange, and then there's one that is absolutely concrete and you know what the author's saying.
Yeah. I've always had this kind of belief that, you know, literary fiction is more convoluted prose and beautiful, you know, beautiful craftsmanship, and it's, you know, it's a slow burn. And but you're saying it's a mix of the style of writing versus the underlying message. So Life of Pi, when it finishes, I have to admit I've only seen the movie. I haven't read the book.
The movie's gorgeous.
At the end, you are left to decide for yourself. Whether it was a metaphorical story or a real story, and it's really up to the reader to make a decision, because they don't spell it out. Well, I know it's kind of alluded to in the final scene. You know, I think when he's in the hospital and he's being interviewed by a police officer or someone, and trying to get to the bottom
shipping
of
company.
That's right. Yes, the manager from the shipping company. So it's ambiguous, and it's left for the reader to, or the viewer to, make up their own mind. So is that a key ingredient for literary fiction?
I think that can be. See, for me, for Life of Pi, I think it's dead set clear exactly what happened. And it's funny because my husband and I argued all the way home from Chermside after we saw it. And I said, what do you mean you have to choose? I said, I know exactly what happened. It's, you know, and I won't say it for those who don't, but for, my husband felt exactly the same way that you feel, Jack. Whereas I said, no, it, if you know that this story is about religion and religion is how we tell ourselves stories in order to cope with the chaos, then it is absolutely clear that this is someone telling a story to cope with the chaos. And my husband was like, no, it's open. And I, you know, and that's when you've it, Emerson, when we were studying and we had 12 people in a workshop and the teacher would see us break out into some sort of combat about somebody's manuscript, the teacher would lean back and say, that's a good story. If you guys are fighting about the feedback, you know, you've done something here.
Yes.
But there's always been that stigma, and as you said, that probably attitudes are changing now towards commercial stories, where people want a really good, engaging story, and they're the stories that are selling. Whereas there probably was this stigma. I remember, I can't remember I heard it, but it was almost like the sort of toffee, looking down over the nose. I'm saying that, if you don't write literary fiction, it's not true writing. It's just it's a hack. It's a commercial sort of thing, but really, I guess it comes down to what do readers want? And if the stuff that's selling are the really engaging stories, and typically they're probably what would be more labeled commercial fiction, with fast pace. James Patterson, some people, you either love him or you hate him, and some people say, oh, it's just more James Patterson trash, whereas I think he's fantastic in the way, the reason why I've read so many of his books, and the reason why I've got probably 35 of his books on my bookshelf right now, is because he writes page turners. They're short, sharp chapters. It's not convoluted prose, and every page, sorry, every the end of every chapter is a cliffhanger, and you want to keep reading. He pushes you through that story. So the traditionalists will say, well, that's not literary fiction, so it's not real, it's not real literature, so.
Oh, well, you know, and when you're talking about that convoluted prose, then I have to say, read Ernest Hemingway, The Old Man and the Sea. That is literary. That is sharp. That man does not waste a word. And you are shown something of the soul, you know? So yeah, I think if you're hiding behind like flowery and stuff, you can, yeah.
Like, even there's writing competitions out there for literary fiction writing competitions, and almost when you read the rules for submission, it's almost, you got to be, they're not interested in anything that would be deemed commercial. It must be literary fiction. And I've often been a bit confused around, well, what's the definition? Who determines whether something is literary as opposed to commercial? And what are your thoughts on that?
I really think it comes back to the stuff that stays with me, the books I keep on my shelf, you know, from my studies that I couldn't get rid of, like All Quiet on the Western Front or The Bell Jar or some of the Hemingway. It's or Flannery O'Connor, who writes short she wrote short stories. It has layers, it has meaning, and it makes you think. And they're using all those wonderful devices, you know. I mean, I still love stuff that's like bubblegum kind of stuff where what was it? There was a series. Oh, I'm drawing a blank right now, but it was a crime thriller. Stephanie Ivanovich. She had a whole series of little paperbacks, and that was just fun. Okay. Is it meaningful? Not really. I just wanted an escape, you know. So that's at one end of the bookshelf. And then at the other end, you know, I will find The Stranger by Camus or Kafka, The Trial, you know, and not necessarily flowery, but existential questions, you know, or just throwing down the gauntlet and making you pay attention and ask, what are you doing here? What are you doing? And
So
that's okay too.
deeper, there's often a deeper meaning.
Yes.
Certainly, there's a lot more layers, a lot more levels of thought have gone into the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
Not so much panting then.
look, maybe. I wonder.
Just lots of editing.
Yes.
So finally, Harry, and I'm really keen to get your thoughts on the genre of crime thrillers or mystery, or there is crossover obviously between those three and the different subgenres of those. Again, from an editor's point of view, what are some issues that you've come across?
Yeah, I'm going to be dead set honest with you here. When somebody comes at me with a crime thriller, and it's a new author, and they say, I haven't published anything yet, but I'm writing this crime, and I'd like you to have a look at it. My first thought is, what are the female characters going to be like? because more often than not, they are just laden with cliches and they're awful. And the thing is, these don't work anymore. Like, that's why I got so excited before, Jack, when I heard you say that you had a female detective, because that's where we're trending, where things are different. You know, we don't, the noir is changing. So, I mean, and I will ask the author to give me that character outline of just, you know, one or two sentences per character. And people should do this anyway for whatever you're writing. But how is the secretary? Okay. How is she contributing to the story? And what's going on with her gender? Why is your secretary using the term secretary? You know, what is this person doing? What are they offering? Are they predictable? Also, does the story open with a dead woman on the ground like that? So many manuscripts open with a dead female, often a sex worker on the ground. And I just think, hasn't this been done? You know, can't, what are you bringing that's new? Show me something new and pay attention to what's going on out there. There's a lot of change up happening as far as empowering characters. And I know that a bit of advice that has been offered for authors who are struggling, they're saying, okay, sorry, I'm caught out. My female characters are kind of flat. My male characters are driving the story. How can I fix that? And one of the bits of advice we tend to give authors is write your female characters like they're you, but you can put them in leggings, okay? Or you can put them in a skirt, but they're you. Says women aren't that different, really. Some, in some ways, like female characters can be just as driven and just as whatever. So that when a male character puts on that, hey, I'm going to write me, except this is a wife instead of a husband doing this job, you know, or if this is a parent, the author's a parent, they can draw on what they know as a father, put it into that mother role. She's a detective as well. And it bring, and there's just something about changing that mindset that helps flesh out the writing. So one of the first things I worry about is how are the female cast members standing up? The other is the cliches, like how many, and knowing the difference between a trope and a cliche. And a trope is your reader's expectation. They, you know, from reading a crime thriller, there better be some crime and there better be some thrill and there better be some tension and some quick pacing and sentences short and sharp. And, you know, really some segments are going to gallop. Maybe there's a chase. Maybe there's, you know, somebody gets eluded. So those are tropes, but when they deteriorate into cliches, oh, and I love this example from, how are we for time? Are we good?
We're good, yeah.
Go for it. This is really interesting.
Okay. Breaking Bad. I love Vince Gilligan. Like, I watched Breaking Bad. I watched Better Call Saul. I just love his characterization. His dialogue is just crash hot. And I like to point out the difference between, you know, something organic in a story and something that's a bit done. And now for those who've seen Breaking Bad, you'll know that it's about Walter, who is diagnosed with lung cancer and turns to meth production because he's a chemistry teacher and his insurance isn't going to cover it. He's going to leave his family in debt when he dies. So he starts producing meth and he finds Jesse, a young man, to help him sell it. So there's a scene where Jesse's bottoming out because he was using the product. And he's lost his home. His parents don't want to know him. He's wearing the clothes on his back kind of situation. It's kind of showing the cost of this life and what it's doing. And he's on the run. And the only place he can stay is the RV, which has been impounded. Okay, of course. So the original thing that Vince Gilligan had planned was that Jesse was going to climb the chain link fence into the junkyard where the RV is impounded and sleep in there for the night. But on his way, he was going to get chased by the junkyard dog. Cliche. We've seen it all. The best time it was done was Stand By Me. Okay, we all love that one. Chopper, yep. Sick Balls, remember? It was great.
Yes, yeah.
But sick after balls. That, we don't want to see it again. And what happened to Vince was in Hollywood, he went to go hire a junkyard actor dog, but the dog trainer said, you have to pay this much money and you have to get two. And Vince said, I don't have that much money and I only want one. So they had to scramble to fill in this plot situation. This beat. So then they went and they got a port-a-john and they had Jesse climb over the fence, stand on the port-a-john, and he crashes through the ceiling of the port-a-john and goes into the blue dye of the toilet and then falls out the door. Everybody who saw this ate it up, and there's nothing cliche about it. So it was a situation where the author was going down, you know, the screenwriter was going down the familiar lane of the cliche, was thrown a curveball by Hollywood, and, you know, stunt dogs. And he ended up with something priceless that everybody remembers. I mean, and the color blue, you know, we talked about motif before. The colors of red, blue, and purple are used as motif. When a character is bad and being bad, they're usually wearing a red shirt or a red tie. If a character is good and they're facing terrible circumstance, they're usually blue. And Jesse's hands were blue for quite some time after that moment. So there's a situation where in a manuscript I might see a cliche and I think, look, the junkyard dogs are just too expensive. What else can you give me here?
Yeah, that's
how's
great
that for an answer?
That's great
good,
advice.
That's good advice.
Always looking for a different a point of difference. And yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Well, look, time has gotten away on us. Lauren, I'd really like to thank you for dedicating your time. We've had three fantastic episodes. Thank you so much. Yeah, we could really spend a lot more time delving into your thoughts and breaking these topics down a lot further. But thank you so much. And again, anyone who would like to find out more, because is there anything else you'd like to add, particularly in terms of the writing workshops that you do? Bit of a plug, the online courses or face-to-face workshops that you run?
Oh, well, I mean, BrisbaneWriters.com. I run Brisbane Writers Workshop. It just became a collective of speakers as well, where I look for people who want to talk on a topic. I also run an author gala where I have a controlled number of people in a council setting. So it's not huge, but it gives authors a chance to sell books and do a quick reading. So I'm really about building a community around here. And I guess for advice, be teachable, just keep learning. The best writers keep learning. They don't stagnate. Yeah. And take lots of courses, take online courses. I mean, there's so much available now, especially post-COVID, where you can stream somebody from LA or London and enjoy it and get some nuggets of truth. So keep learning.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Wonderful. So thanks, Harry. Anything else you'd like to add before we finish up?
No, I think Lauren's given us some wonderful advice, and I will always remember that junkyard dog sort of scenario and come up with some. Any time I start sliding into a cliche, it's like, nah, got to come up with something weird.
Yeah.
Good. Yes, thank you. And thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to share this excitement. And I do enjoy talking about this stuff. And you guys are fantastic. I hope this podcast travels well.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And your enthusiasm is contagious. And, you know, the fact that you do get goosebumps when you're talking about things, it's quite clear that you're very passionate about this. And from being a student of one of your workshops, that certainly comes through with the way you teach the stuff that you know so well. So thank you so much for time. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you, and an honor to have you on our humble little podcast. And for those people listening in, I'm sure this has been of great value to you. So thanks again. Stay tuned for our next episode, and all the best, everyone. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.